Introducing Coco Gauff's signature shoe, more than just a tennis shoe. It's a fusion of 90s-inspired style and cutting-edge performance technology. With its sleek mid-cut silhouette, it's designed to enhance speed and power on the court. The multi-piece upper construction delivers high-energy return for players of all levels. Whether you're a seasoned pro or just starting out, the Coco CG1 empowers you to dominate the game. Learn more and purchase the Coco CG1 at NewBalance.com.
Welcome to the Behind the Racket Pod, the podcast taking you behind the racket with today's top tennis players and biggest issues facing the sport.
Behind the Racket is a community to give fans and players in the world of tennis the opportunity to open up like they have never done before.
Visit BehindTheRacket.com for the latest stories, merch, as well as direct links to all of the latest podcasts. It can also be found on iTunes, Google Play, Pandora, Stitcher, and wherever you find your podcasts. Download the episodes and make sure to leave a review.
And we want you to be a part of the conversation. Find me at NoahRubin33 or Mike at MikeCTennis on all forms of social media. You can also learn more at BehindTheRacket.com or MikeCTennis.com.
Special thanks to my sponsor, New Balance. Visit their latest shoes and styles at NewBalance.com and learn more about their program of giving back at #NBGivesBack.
You can also help support the podcast by visiting patreon.com/behindtheracketpod and receive rewards from our travels around the world. And now.
A couple of weeks ago, Noah and I were in Cary, North Carolina, and we were just kind of talking about, you know, where are certain people that weren't there with us. And I remember two names that came up. First was Colin Altamirano, and we just kind of decided he was somewhere in like South America playing some futures or something, doing that. The other name that came up was Jared Donaldson. And we're so excited to talk to Jared right now. And what's really unique about the fact that we're talking to Jared on a Saturday is he told us beforehand that he was taking the ACT this morning. So explain to us why you're taking the ACT, Jared.
All right. So I think I told somebody else that it's something that I never thought that I would be taking or having to go, the process of which having to go through in my life, right, of taking a standardized test. No, I don't know. I know. Did you ever take ACT or SAT? Oh, but you went to college. I forgot about that for a year.
Yeah, no, I mean, I tried to fake it, but I couldn't. So, you know, I actually had to take the SAT. Never took the ACT, though.
You took the SAT. So,
yeah.
So I was actually planning on taking the SAT originally. But I guess take a step back. So the reason why I was taking the, you know, a standardized test or, you know, is because, you know, obviously with the trials and tribulations of my knee injury, I want to be prepared. I want to, you know, either be competing in professional tennis next year at some point, or if that is not a reality, or, you know, if it appears that my knee isn't going to get better, that I'm, you know, enrolled in university somewhere. That's not to say that I expect my knee won't get better. I mean, I had my second surgery on my knee in March of this year. I snuck it in just before there were the non-mandatory surgery restrictions,
right,
here in California. I would say my progress on my injury is slow but improving. It's a little bit, I would say I'm definitely I'm behind my expectations of where I thought I would be and where I was kind of led to believe I would be, but it is getting better. So, you know, you can take it for what it is, glass half empty, glass half full. So that's why I'm taking, you know, a standardized test. And
Did you do okay?
Hope springs eternal. this is the second time I'm taking it.
Okay.
I took it once. So I took it once actually in Utah. So this is a totally different world than tennis, right?
Right.
I'm breaking into a normal high school adolescent, which I'm 24 years old. So I'm going backwards on all fronts. So if you were, you know, needing to take a standardized test, specifically in California, they were shut due to COVID. They were, you know, shut down or, you know, not administering the tests, I think, since the lockdowns were in place all the way through, actually, I believe the summer in California. And then they opened up test taking in September or so, I believe, because I actually had an SAT schedule at the end of August and it was canceled. So through the tutor I was working with in the company, she, you know, recommended, hey, just because we don't know how this whole thing, you know, nobody knows how the whole health situation is going to play out. Although I guess it's a little bit, it seems to be close to an end, hopefully, you know, fingers crossed, you know, when we can all hope with a vaccine coming out and so forth. But, you know, at the time, we don't know how this is going to play out. California is a little bit more restrictive than, say, a state like Utah.
Yeah.
So, or at the time, I think it was Arizona, maybe even Nevada. So, you know, some students are flying to certain locales where they're more confident that that they will not stop administering tests. So in the middle of October, I flew to Utah and took the test. I actually flew with my father. So it was like, you know, it was like a throwback to a tennis tournament. You know what I mean? Like, staying in the hotel, you know, okay, what am I going to have my pre-test taking meal, the whole thing? I mean,
just less luggage.
Yeah, less luggage. I think I took like a backpack and like one change of clothes. I received the 28, which was a little bit lower than what I was kind of, you know, I mean, look, I think Noah can probably attest to this too. I wouldn't be satisfied with anything less than a 36. So that's, you know, kind of what I was shooting for. I don't think I got a 36 this time around. Obviously, I'm hope, you know, as I said, hope springs eternal, right?
Yeah.
We can all dream, but I would be shocked if I did worse this time. I would be blown away if I did worse this time. I mean, and then once you factor in all the adjustments you can make on all these standardized tests with the super scoring, I mean, you know, it's kind of like, we all know the tennis pro who, you know, played maybe a little bit of, exaggerates their credentials, you know.
Yeah, right.
Who was 1,000 in the world when they played, and 20 years later, you know, they were in the final, the, you know, last eight of a grand slam. So hopefully maybe I can, you know, kind of with the adjustments and stuff, I can kind of do something similar.
I do have to say that, you know, all truth, we were speaking to Stefan about this and we were reminiscing on the Barcelona days that we had at the Junior Davis Cup. That was kind of where you broke into kind of our radar earlier on. You broke through, I think, you know, because we were about 16. I think around 13 years old, that wasn't necessarily your peak. You started getting better around 16 to 18, and then obviously 18 to, you know, 20, 21. And I was like, I remember they texted me, he's like, Jared Donaldson. I'm like, Jared Donaldson? Okay, let's see what this is all about. We take a trip, play Junior Davis Cup, a lot of fun. And that's kind of where, you know, we all became friends and we started making fun of your Rhode Island accent.
Yes. So you're building me up a little bit, Noah, and saying that I broke through. I didn't even really play. I mean, let's be honest. I didn't really play. I mean, I'm not, you know, it is what it is. I didn't play in Junior Davis Cup. So I shouldn't really, I guess the cat's out of the bag now, but in my, on one of my college applications, I actually put, you know, we finished third place. You know, I said, you know, US, you know, Junior Davis Cup team member, third place. I didn't have the characters to list my fellow teammates, but let's be honest. I think I played all the dead doubles matches. I don't think one doubles match even count, did it? So I really didn't even play a meaningful match. You guys completely carried to the title, right? I mean, to say that I kind of like broke through was on your level. I mean, the truth of the matter was I was not on your level at that point.
I mean, you're the third player to come with us to Barcelona. Believe me.
But there was at the time, there was a significant delta between you, Stefan, and me, you know, like I felt like I deserved, right? That's kind of a, you know, a tricky word, but I feel like I did deserve at the time the third, to be the third member, but there was not like a close gap between, you, myself and Stefan. You guys were obviously the better players.
And then we blink our eyes.
Thank you for allowing me to boost my credential on my college app to take third place. That's pretty good. That's better than just competing in Junior Davis Cup. You know? Got on the podium. But here's actually, Noah, I'll throw this back to you.
Okay, please do.
I've often said this. I am really shocked at, first of all, we all have to puff out our chests here a little bit. Okay. And you guys in particular, we beat the best team or the players that became the best, I mean, handedly, right? I mean, Russia had, I think, listen, for people who don't know that, the team that at that point, I mean, Kachanov played one, Medvedev played two,
Jesus.
And Rublev played three. So wow. I don't know what Kachanov is ranked, top 20 right now, is he? Is he top 10?
I mean, he's been top 10.
So three top 10 players. And I think we want you got you like smoke Kachanov, like, yeah. 3-2, 4-2 or something.
Yeah, something like that.
Stefan beat Medvedev, what, like 5-2, 5-1,
yeah.
Whatever. And then I think we won the doubles in straight sets. I competed, thank you, with Stefan. So I think we won in straight sets. It might have been three, but we'll say straights so it sounds better. But I've always been kind of shocked at how few of those players actually quote unquote, like, made it to a relatively high level. Right. I mean, like, cause think about it, of the top three teams, it was Australia.
Right. I lost to Kokkinakis. Yeah.
And us and Tanasi was top 100 and actually, and I got top 100 and were you ever top 100?
120.
120?
Yeah.
So only two players in the top. Yeah, you're not top 100, top 100.
Right, and then all of Russia. But no, it was it was stacked to some extent. I brought up to Stefan. He had 8 match points against Australia at that point.
Do you remember him just starting drop shotting like crazy against Harry Bouchier?
I feel like you could say that about every match he's ever played, though.
No, but like, if you saw this was like, whoa, like, what is happening? I mean,
see, but I remember next to Jared.
Drop shots.
No, but I remember being next to Jared and I said, well, he had 8 chances. Drop shot 8 times, you're going to win one of them. You know, stats are in your favor. But yeah, we blinked our eyes and then Jared was screaming in Monte Carlo and he was 60 in the world. So it was funny how things really changed.
That moment will outdate my professional tennis career.
But here's the thing. Let me just say, Noah says blink and all of a sudden you're top 60 in Monaco and all that. For me, as the older of the three here, I talked to your dad quite a bit. And I
love
talked to
dad.
The Dents as well as when you were working with them. And they always said to me, with regard to your career, that they looked at it as a long process. Whereas a lot of players who are 17, 18, looking to win those titles right away, get to top 100 right away. For you, it was always about the long process. So you would be 20, you're at your best at the age of 23, 24. Unfortunately, obviously injury hampered that. How do you feel that your development differed from some of the other guys that you did come up with in that group?
Well, I mean, I certainly think that my career trajectory was not very similar to other, top players. I mean, because I don't know if you remember, but I first met you at the 12s Orange Bowl, which actually, if you think about the 12s Orange Bowl, I mean, that was a stacked tournament. I mean, if you can, like, they had four. I played Tommy Paul in the round of 32. I mean, I'm going to answer your question in a minute.
Yeah, you're fine.
Like an aside to just show that how really, competitive our junior level was. I mean, we all came.
I lost to Koric in the 3-4 playoff.
Yeah. And I lost to Tommy Paul in the round of 32, who then played Koric. Tanasi was there. He might have got like what quarters. Yeah. Haeyoung Chung got lost in the finals to that Brazilian kid.
The Brazilian kid. That's
yeah. And I mean, I'm sure I'm probably blanking on it. I don't know. John Luigi didn't play that, right? He wasn't there for that, right?
No, he maybe not at that time, but he was. Yeah, he was nearly
Stefan,
that.
Stefan played it.
Yeah.
Hallease, I'm sure probably played it, right or no?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, yeah.
This the names that I listed there.
Yeah.
They all, you know, Haeyoung Chung, semifinals of, he was a really, really good junior from 12 all the way to obviously now great professional. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I think, you know, like I mentioned, I lost in the round of 32. In the 14s, I was a top ranked junior. I'm not saying for the United States, but not internationally. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I really, and even in the ITFs, I mean, I don't even think I actually ever broke top 100 ITF juniors. I mean, maybe like 97 or something.
You're
like
an embarrassing that. Tennis player.
I know, right? I mean, but I'm just saying, yes. For someone who you would suspect, you know, who, you know,
to make top 100, is, yes.
Yeah. And also, but in a relatively young age, I mean, I was in the 21 and under, I qualified for the 21 under next gen.
Right.
When I was 21, the inaugural run and whatnot. Obviously, I think I was like fifth. So Medvedev was I think the sixth player that qualified, and I think the fourth was like Porich or Chung or something like that. But then you have guys like Zverev, who I don't know what was he like 19 in top 10 or 18, you know,
yeah.
18 doing exceptionally well. So and he was a very obviously very good junior one. So I you know I took you know, kind of a, like a little bit of a, I kind of didn't advocate the juniors, but I was not, you know, that good of a juniors. And then when I came back from Argentina, I stopped playing for a little bit.
Right.
And then when I, you know, wanted to play competitively again, I said, okay, you know, obviously juniors is probably, I'm just going to focus on pros because those were really like the most competitive tournaments I could get into. I had kind of sacrificed my ITF career with playing more futures and taking some time off. You know what I mean? And then I think Kalamazoo, whatever year that was, 2013, 2014 was, you know, got lost in the finals, 16 to Colin Altamirano, the other missing in action,
yeah.
American player, right. Who still plays,
took me out in the semis there.
I did take you on the semis there. Yes, I did. It's like every round I thought I was going to lose in that tournament. Like I really had no expectations. I remember I was talking to Luca Quarantelli before the match and he said, and I said, yeah, you know, I don't know. I'm just trying to do the best that I can. I consider myself somewhat of a realist. I think I was seeded like 13, but I thought, yeah, that's probably as far as I'm going to get. I almost lost in the first round to AJ Catanzariti, saved a couple match points, won in the third set tie break. Getting to the round of 16, I thought I was going to lose to Conor Farren. I ended up winning in three sets. Quarters, I thought I was going to lose to Luca Quarantelli because all these players were better juniors than me.
Yeah.
I ended up beating Luca in the quarters. I ended up playing Noah, and I thought, okay, I'm probably going to lose to Noah, but, you know, I hope I can win because I viewed them as better players. And, you know, I hit lightning in a bottle winning that match. And then the match I thought I was going to win against Colin Altamirano, I lost easy. I said to somebody at the beginning of the tournament, man, he doesn't look that good. Someone told me, oh, you know, this kid's really good. No, because Colin was unseeded. And I
yeah.
said, yeah, I think he's good. I ended up losing like 4-3 and 2. So that's how much I knew, right? Throughout the tournament, I was like wrong every step of the way. But to get back to the original question, I know I went on a long tangent.
You're good.
Yes, I always kind of considered, even from when I think my first coach, Mario, always kind of looked at like the long game, you know
yeah.
what I mean? And tried to, you know, play for the future. I know that term is kind of thrown around and sometimes undefined, or defined differently for others. But for me, that always meant, hey, I'm going to work on the things that I think are going to be beneficial when I'm, you know, at maximum maturity
yeah.
in terms of physical strength, mental maturity when, I don't know if I, truthfully, I don't think I ever really even reached like quote unquote mental maturity when I was a player.
I would agree.
I wish that I hope that I get better because I think that it's a shame if I couldn't, you know, play and really, you know, I'm older, I'm, you know, I'm, better, well-read, you know, just different frame of mind. I mean, you know, I can, at the time, I don't know, Noah, but when you're younger, it was tough to play for the long game too. And yes. Kind of like say, okay, I'm, you know, it's not an excuse to lose the match, but maybe doing some game plans or working on things that might be beneficial to the level you're at now, or that might work against his opponent, but won't work as well down the road. I remember when I won my first challenger, I think is a great perspective. I was 18 and I won the Maui Challenger.
Yeah.
I don't know what year that was.
2015. You beat Nick Meister 1-4.
I won doubles with Stefan Kozlov.
Yes, you did. Yes, you did.
So coming from Junior Davis Cup comes full circle. And I got home and I was like, I was pretty excited. You know, I mean, we took a red eye. My coach at the time, Alejandro, I was like, man, you know, this is so easy. I'm top 10 in, you know, 3 months, you know, literally, you know, because I had like a pretty quick trajectory in terms of improvement. And, you know, I got home and I thought Taylor was going to, you know, I lived with the Dents at the time.
Yeah.
And I thought he was just going to heap praise and say, wow, you know, this is so great. You know, you're amazing. You know, all hail, you know, the next great tennis player, you know, literally. I mean, I'm obviously building it up for dramatic effect, but that was basically what I thought. And he said, man, you know, that was awful. That finals was awful. I was like, and I played Nick Meister, who lived in Southern California, and actually I trained with quite a lot when he was playing, because he lived in Orange County, and I obviously trained and lived in Orange County also. And he said you were playing so far back, and you were playing that, and you weren't taking the ball early, you weren't even really opening up the court that much. I can't even believe you won the tournament. And it was such a shock. I honestly was like, what? But I think that story kind of sums up, and that didn't come from me.
Yeah.
That type of sentiment was shared by my father, but he was super excited because he didn't go to that tournament with me, but he was super excited when I won. You know, he called me and I was obviously excited, and you know, my dad's not, you know, former top 20 tennis player like Taylor was, but it was the people I think around me. I was always extremely lucky. I think just by, you know, surreptitiously lucky or the meetings and the people I interacted with in the tennis world and my coaches and just the people who supported me and stuff, I serendipitously, you know, fell into these relationships where they always pushed the long game and always had the knowledge to understand what would work at the next level.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yes.
And that's a sentiment that my father understood and I understood and that resonated with me. I should say resonated. But I didn't know at the time what was truly going to work when I was 18. I just knew, or 16 or 15, you know, I was just doing what I was kind of told and having those people in place, I think, you know, really is what, you know, allowed me to excel, you know, in tennis up until a level.
I was just looking at actually, so I did the Behind the Racket with you. I thought it was last year, but last year was when it got canceled. and it's, my years are getting mixed up. So it was 2019. We did the Behind the Racket story together. Yeah. Talk about, let's finish up here, but let's talk about kind of the road. You talk about the long game. You said it a few times here. How are you keeping motivation? You're saying that you're hopefully going to be playing. Are you just extremely excited to possibly get back on court again? Do you want to be as great as you can be? What are the thoughts going into kind of?
And also to add on that, just where is your knee? What's up with your knee right now too?
So, I mean, what's up with my knee? I mean, I'm hitting. I'm not quite at the point to where I can hit live ball. I'm really hopeful that's really soon, you know, hope maybe, you know, at the end of next week, maybe the following week, but hoping that, you know, it's in a real, I'm really close to be able to hit live ball. And, you know, if everything goes, you know, I keep progressing, I would hope that I could maybe compete again you know, assuming, you know, whatever happens with the tennis schedule, I guess that that's kind of, you know, opaque right now, but, you know, maybe in like late February, early March, that's kind of what I'm hoping. Mm-hmm. Just because, you know, I have to get in shape again. I mean, this is two surgeries. The first one, you know, after the first surgery, I hadn't lost as much muscle and mass and all that. And it was more closer to where I was still, you know, working out, you know, hard and extensively. So hopefully I'm in that range. That's kind of what I'm shooting for. What was your question? I forgot.
No, just how you are feeling. I mean, what has been the road like, you know, mentally?
Yeah. I mean, you know, kind of like I don't miss it as much as maybe, you know, someone else would. I don't miss the playing part. For me, tennis was never, I never was like, oh, let's go hit. I just love hitting. I don't care. There always had to be something kind of on the line, like an engagement or what I got out of tennis was the competition and the, you know, the joy of trying to pursue something that was really difficult to attain and achieve. And really hard also, like competing against Noah in the semifinals at Kalamazoo. That's, you know, like, that's what I lived for at the time, right? Like playing against, you know, the best 18 under junior in the country and trying to beat him, you know, in tennis and trying to win. That's, you know, that's like a thrill for me, like the nerves, the adrenaline, you know, competing at USO, you know, all these tournaments, like just the competition, the one-on-one. I like the one-on-one aspect. You were, you know, you lose by yourself and win by yourself. I hated the team aspect because when I was really young, because, you know, you won as a team, you lost as a team, regardless of how each individual part did. Right. And me being competitive, I was always, you know, really aggressive, but I don't miss the tennis aspect, but I miss the competing. And, you know, I will say that I'm in a different spot. It's not like I'm retiring because my skill has, or I'm not retiring. But what I mean to say is, if I was 33 or older, you know, my skill had diminished to a point where I wasn't really, you know, I wasn't excited or didn't have the motivation to go compete, that would be a different topic. But my inhibiting factor is just pain. I did experience pain before surgery, you know, after Wimbledon during Wimbledon of 2018, that's where I heard it the day before or 2 days before the tournament started. And that is not fun, you know, dealing with pain every day. And so if it doesn't get better, it's not because I lost motivation. It's because I physically am not able to perform, you know, at a level even resembling, you know, what would be required to try to pursue this, you know? So if my pain diminishes, I'm able to do it, I'm motivated, you know, to go out and compete and try again.
Kind of a two-part question for me in that regard, Jared. I'm wondering, number one, who you've spoken to in terms of maybe other athletes, you know, to kind of get an understanding of how to, you know, what to expect with the knee. And then I'm also wondering, I guess, how you're handling the expectation of what to expect from yourself when you do start competing again. Are you being forgiving in that regard?
So I'll answer the second part of your question first.
Yeah.
I think that will depend on that. And that question will be answered if I start competing again. Right. I mean, I can sit here and say, oh, you know, there's no pressure, but we all know that that's not true. You know, I have, for a protected ranking, I have a limited amount of tournaments, right? I mean, that's just the bottom line of it, right? I have a limited amount of tournaments. There's ranking points. There's tournaments you want to get into, the whole deal. So, you know, we could all say, oh, it doesn't matter the first three tournaments. And obviously that would be the great mindset. I think that it's impossible to put that aside. Those are just the realities of, you know, of being a professional tennis player. Being a professional tennis player and you know, in any profession, right? And we could all say, if you're running a business, right? I mean, you could say, hey, you know, we're not focused on profitability. We're focused on, but that's just if you want to remain a going concern, you have to make money. You have to, you know, be able to provide, you know, economic benefit for both parties, right? So we'll see. That's to be determined. The first part, speaking to other athletes, you know, unfortunately, I'm in a little bit of uncharted waters in this regard in terms of my knee, because what I have is patella tendinosis, which is chronic tendinitis. I mean, it's a pretty, you know, unfortunately lame injury to, if it does end my career, say, hey, you know, I stopped because I had, you know, chronic tendinitis. I mean, that's not like, oh, I was playing and I slid and, you know, crazy match. It was 5 days and, you know, I just never recovered, right? It's just, you know, chronic wear and tear for whatever reason. What I can tell you is that when I originally, I did not just immediately get surgery. I had 8 months of rehab.
Yeah.
And the thinking was, and, you know, everybody I consulted with, which was multiple doctors, multiple physical therapists, chiropractors, you name it, said, you know, that doing rehab will usually fixes the issues that you have. It didn't. It was 8 months, and I kind of said, look, I don't really see any marginal benefit at this point to keep doing rehab. I mean, they say, you know, do rehab for a year and a half. What am I going to, you know, do rehab for a year and a half, you know, wait a year and a half to play tennis? I have to be a little bit more, you know, proactive in terms of trying to get this better, not wait. And I wasn't seeing that much result after a while. So I consulted with doctors and said, you know, what can I do? What can I do? You know, this, that, and the other. And did a surgery, had a surgery performed after consulting with probably four or five different surgeons at Stanford. Didn't take for whatever reason. Had, you know, afterwards when it kind of was clear that I wasn't really getting better, had an injection of what is that called? The thing that Agassi used to have before he retired on his back.
An epidural?
Not an epidural. You only get them two times, I think, in a certain spot. You're supposed to get them injected.
Hmm.
Whatever. I'll think of it in a minute. But I had that. And it's one of those – and this is the type of injection where you're not supposed to get it. It's not supposed to be put in the ligament, because that will damage – that will, or the tendon, because that will damage the ligament or tendon – and it'll be more easily to rupt or tear or whatever. So I did not have it injected in my tendon, for any doctors out there who know what I'm talking about. But anyways, and under ultrasound. So I'm just going through detail just to make it sound like, you know, I'm not like, you know, cowboying it or doing something hokey, and that's why it's not getting better, you know. It didn't work. I had a PRP injection. That is supposed to solve it. I did a little bit reverse. I had the surgery, then PRP. Normally you have PRP, then surgery, but PRP is less effective for what I have than surgery. If PRP is something like 70% effective, surgery is like 90% effective or something like that.
Okay.
And then after the second surgery, you know, that's kind of like, you know, quote unquote, the last line of action you can take. I mean, there, you know, I consulted with four or five additional doctors who I had not talked to before my first surgery, different surgeons. And, you know, they kind of said, well, you know, wait a year, about a year, you know, but they all said in concert that it should be better by now. You should not be feeling pain. You should be able to do more. You know, something obviously is clearly not right. Not saying that, and this is not to say that the doctor who did my original surgery performed some sort of malpractice, you know, operation. It just didn't take for whatever reason.
Yeah.
No doctor can really, you know, articulate why. It's, you know, going through this whole process, I've learned that it is, or that it embodies the practice of medicine, not the science of medicine, right? They call it the practice of medicine. So you know, it's a little bit of an art. You know, I think we'd like to all think of it as a science, 100% science, but it's an art.
Yeah.
And anyways, so the second surgery, here I am. I had a little bit different of a technique done in terms of the procedure that was done or technique used, and fingers crossed. But you know, if not, you know, hopefully my test went well today.
it's funny because I remember talking to you, your dad, and your sister up in the Players Lounge at the U.S. Open, and all four of us, we were just talking about how it was really important to just have different perspectives on life, and I can clearly see that with you. Before we go here, Jared, because we try to keep it around half an hour, but you reached out to me.
Taking long-winded answers.
No, it's great for us because, you know, we like to actually engage and let you guys talk because nobody wants to hear from Noah ever. So
that's not true. I want to hear from Noah.
Oh, he'll talk to you for a while if you want. It's all right. He's little. He'll handle it fine. You reached out to me last week because you and I share a love of the game of poker. And yes. in talking and listening to you today.
Yeah.
And your analytical brain and your ability to remember results from your 12, 13 years ago. I never want to play poker with you ever. Like, your brain is something else, man. Like, I can't imagine or fathom that.
It's being boosted a little bit right now. So I think that's also contributing to my my long-winded answers, honestly. But
you seem to have a truly an analytical brain that has that ability to memorize things and then have that recall that's necessary in kind of important moments.
I mean, I don't know what people use the word photographic memory. Yeah. I don't know exactly what I've never looked up what the pure definition of photographic memory. I mean, I obviously can't remember everything in my life, but I think everybody was born with certain gifts.
Yeah.
I have a gift. I do have a, you know, gift for recall. Whether or not I have a photographic memory, I don't know, but I can remember instances and, you know, that's, we all have our advantages.
There's Mike's pile of mush up there. So that's good. We all have something in common.
But the problem is, Mike, is unfortunately,
yeah,
my mathematical skills could be improved a little bit.
Okay.
So for doing, you know, quick odd calculations and expected values and, you know, what are the odds of this?
Yeah.
I need a little bit refresher on it for poker to really, you know, really. I've wondered because I've played a decent amount of live poker.
Yeah.
I would love to know if I'm a lifetime winner live.
Oh, you don't keep track?
Of live?
Yeah.
I don't keep track of live. Online, I am a lifetime winner.
Yeah. Are you playing cash or tournament?
I don't play that much.
Okay.
But live, I would love to know.
Are you playing cash mostly or tournaments?
Live, I play cash.
Yeah.
I built my bankroll online.
Yeah.
By playing sit and goes.
Yes.
And I felt like I was pretty good. I felt like, I mean, I had probably a decent win rate when I played.
Yeah.
And then I've also had some decent tournament scores online.
Yeah. Well,
not like huge, but for, you know, $10 buy and getting, you know, I'm talking placing.
Yeah.
Never won one. I best was second place, but.
No, Noah's sitting over here bored. I send him all these texts and pictures of all the scores that I have this year.
Yo, but yeah, man, when I play 5-10, you know, it's crazy though. Like,
no, you on it? You don't like playing poker?
No, I have an addictive personality. So, you know, if I get into something like that, which, you know,
there are so many similarities between poker and tennis. It's ridiculous in terms of the analytics. Like if I'm playing Jared, he's making an adjustment to how I'm playing. And then I have to make a counter adjustment to how he's playing.
Thing that I can lose at and you make fun of me. Great.
Yes.
Fantastic. No,
I'm actually, because we also have, I don't know if you guys have brought up before, but we have to acknowledge how many tennis players love poker.
Yes, 100%.
I mean, yeah, but how many out of those are actually good?
Good question. But I will say this for tennis players, Noah. Like you just mentioned, addictive personality you have. And I remember rooming with you in Barcelona. That's 100% true. You're very formulaic and you have your method and stuff like that, and obviously been very, very successful with it. Right. I'm not as organized in terms, but I still have my, you know, routines and whatnot. But I think most tennis players, when they put their, or cause look, at the end of the day, we're all very high achieving, individuals. I mean, not to brag, but I think that just needs to be said. So I think And I mean, just because of the socioeconomics and so forth, most probably come from a higher middle class background. And my father has always thought that a tennis player has probably a little bit higher of a cognitive function, and people who probably like play it, it relates to them, probably a little bit higher of a cognitive function than maybe other sports. I hope I don't get in trouble for saying. I just think that's true. I'm not using an empirical study, but I would say just that one could probably surmise that, right?
Yeah.
You have to be careful, I guess, what you say now, but one could probably surmise. I don't think that's a crazy assumption. But I think that if you just don't like it, that's fine. But I think that if you put your mind to it and said, hey, I like it, you would be successful.
Agreed.
At it. I mean, if you put it, because it's just like anything else, if you put in the time, of something, you're going to get better. Are you going to be, I don't know who who's the best, Phil Ivey. I mean,
right.
I don't know if Phil Ivey is like the modern day analytical guy. I don't know, Ben, but there's a guy, a lot of online, but whatever. But you would probably be, better than,
very
than
good.
Your average than
yes.
the median player, right?
Correct.
Yeah, I just don't want to take it away from Michael over here. he tries really hard. He puts it all out there. And my girlfriend hates it. My addictive personality comes because I just like being good at things.
That's exactly what I'm saying.
Right. That's what it comes down to. I will, for hours on end, and I will put in time. If I am horrendous, I will become good in one way or another. But then I take it away from poor Michael, and we just can't.
You got to let me have something, damn it.
You have a mohawk. That's what you
let
have.
Let me emphasize that is an unusual trait amongst, because I'm just thinking about, I'm going to get in trouble.
I'm the one that usually gets in trouble. So please take it away.
Okay. If my normal friends listen to this, that is an unusual, a trait, normal. I'm saying non-tennis,
right.
Excuse me, but non-tennis friends, that is not, I would say, as present as tennis players I've encountered. And I actually would struggle to maybe, I think of maybe a couple that have that, but not to the same that even those that have it, they don't have it to the same granular level of what you've probably played tennis multiple hours a day since you were, when did you start playing? I mean, 96. No, didn't your father say that you, that like 1 year old?
Yeah. I was hitting for a ball.
So 23 years, of really intense. I mean, that's a career. Some people work 23 years after they, as a career. So that emphasizes my point. That's emphatic. So Noah, you would succeed in any, as would you, Mike. Obviously, I'm obviously heaping praise on Noah, but I think that those who aspire to be great would achieve maybe at differing levels depending on the required traits. But whatever.
Well, and I appreciate all of the compliment. Please, Mike doesn't give me any. So
yeah,
thank
true.
You. But
yeah, I'm trying to back you up. I'm trying to pump you up.
But Mike will show you why he won't be successful, and if you just lift
you
this,
want me to
do this,
yeah, I mean,
yeah,
this,
just do it,
yeah,
there looks, we go, there's a mohawk there, and that's why, yeah, there's impending failure.
It looks good.
I like there. The mohawk.
Yeah, I mean,
young at heart, Mike. Young at heart.
Bless your heart, Jared. I do miss you quite a bit. I miss those quad slaps when you're upset. The Jared, I miss that quite a bit. And I know there are a lot of people, not just obviously us who have gotten to know you, but so many fans who really want to be able to see you play again. And more than anything, just be healthy and happy and doing whatever it is that you love. And I know I miss having you out there, and I hope that we get to see you out there again soon.
Yeah, thanks. I appreciate it. And yes, I gave a long answer. I do miss it. I want to be out there. I just want to make that 100% clear, because I don't want people to my fear of, I've been very quiet. Actually, I've only told a handful of people that I've been studying for the ACT, because my fear is that people will think, hey, he doesn't care about tennis anymore. He's not taking it seriously.
Yeah.
I'm taking it seriously. I'm training every day. I'm going to PT almost, almost every day, in the gym every day. So I really want to be out there, and I do miss it, but we also have to, live in reality that it may,
yep.
It may not get better. So
we're waiting for you
about it, but I hope to see you guys, in person.
Yeah,
with no COVID, no masks.
Yeah, for
come
sure.
On. Tennis, normal tennis with crowds, and it's great.
Yeah.
What tennis did you play? we're excited to be waiting for you. Best of luck with everything.
Thank you. I appreciate it. You guys too. I love it. Thank you.
All right, and give my best to your dad, especially, who I've gotten to talk to a lot. Okay.
I will definitely do that. And great job. I love listening to you guys.
Oh, thanks. Take care of yourself, okay?
Thank you.
All right, bye.
Bye.
Introducing Coco Gauff's signature shoe, more than just a tennis shoe. It's a fusion of 90s-inspired style and cutting-edge performance technology. With its sleek mid-cut silhouette, it's designed to enhance speed and power on the court. The multi-piece upper construction delivers high-energy return for players of all levels. Whether you're a seasoned pro or just starting out, the Coco CG1 empowers you to dominate the game. Learn more and purchase the Coco CG1 at NewBalance.com.
The show might be over, but the conversation isn't. Join us on social media at NoahRubin33, at MikeCTennis, and at Behind the Racket.
Expect new episodes every Monday or Tuesday. And don't forget to leave us a rating on iTunes. It really helps us expand and reach more listeners as we take you behind the racket.